Welcome to this episode of Freer Thinking. I'm Adriel Lewis, a curator with the Smithsonian's Asian Pacific American Center. Glad we're together. This podcast is all about thinking freer, about the museum, its collections, and the big ideas they provoke. So to begin on a light and cheery note, apocalypse is our theme. Many societies at different times have felt like the world was descending into chaos, and art has always been a key tool to help make sense of the chaos. This episode will highlight stories of apocalypse within the museum. So let's get started. Destruction in its many forms is on display throughout the museum. And here in this gallery, it's in the figure Shiva Nataraja. Shiva's arms spin wildly in all directions and bronze flames spit out in a ring around him. Below Shiva's feet, there's a figure. Some say that represents ignorance, and he's being stomped out. The god Shiva looks straight ahead.
Shiva is a transcendent, all-powerful, formless, beyond time, absolute essence of the universe. And he also takes on many manifestations or forms that are accessible to us. And one of the most important of his forms is as Lord of the Dance, as Nataraja.
Deborah Diamond is curator of South and Southeast Asian art here at the Freer and Sackler Galleries. I asked her how Shiva's dance relates to destruction.
It's the fierce stomping of his feet, every gesture of his dance that destroys the universe, but there's no destruction without recreation. If you look at this bronze created around 1000 in South India, what's extraordinary is that the artists have conveyed both the fierce power, the frightening destruction. His hair fans out in every direction. His arms, his forearms move in four directions. And at the same time, it's a very graceful and centered posture. And his face is extraordinarily kind. He has a gentle smile and he's looking straight at us and he has a hand raised. And that gesture means have no fear.
It seems like that destruction and that creation are maybe seen as opposites from a Western perspective. But how does that shift when we look at it from this perspective?
The apocalypse seems like a one-time event and quite terrifying and complete. And in this Hindu system, it's part of a cycle, an ongoing cycle. It's natural and recurring. So on an individual level, I mean, we all know of the pain of death and the joy of a baby being born. You can understand it in that way. And some Hindu teachers in the past and in the present, you talk about this in the context of every day. You know, you go to sleep and you wake up and you can recreate the world afresh.
I've never cast my own bronze sculpture before, but when I think about the creation of something like this, I'm imagining metals being shifted and melted, fire involved, and it seems that in a lot of ways, the creation of this sculpture is represented in the sculpture itself. Would you agree with that?
Yes, actually, I think that's brilliant. First, an artist will sculpt it out of a hard wax, and that wax is then encased in layers of clay. The clay is fired, and the wax pours out. So that first form of Shiva that's created, actually, the wax dissolves. It's gone. And then in that hollow form in the clay, this fiery mix of five metals is poured.
Well, let's talk about this object and the fact that it is now at the Freer Gallery, but that is not where it was created with intention to be. How does the context of this piece change from its original context to now sitting in a museum?
We're here in the gallery and the sound is hushed. It's absolutely quiet. There's beautiful light coming down from a skylight. So we can see it with great clarity. If we encountered him in South India, it would be entirely different. We might be on a street in a town or city in Tamil Nadu in southeastern India, and we'd hear all of a sudden like loud blaring conch shells and the drums beating, and Nataraja would be coming to us in a procession to where we live, anywhere in the city or perhaps by the beach. And there'd be scores of devotees pulling his wooden chariot down the street. And we would jostle with others to get close, to get a glimpse of Nataraja. And he would be almost entirely covered in silks and flower garlands and gold jewelry. The only thing really that would be visible would be his face and his eyes. As a devotee, you might be bringing a gift to God, bringing a coconut. And people don't bring coconuts to the museum.
I wish they did.
I know. I'm always trying to mention this in the hopes that people will start to pile up coconuts. The conservators really hate that when I do that.
Even without coconuts in the museum, this gorgeous work of art is a good reminder that when it feels like the world is falling apart, something radiant could emerge from the ashes. And that is not only good guidance for Hindu followers. It's also the actual story of a special collection of ceramics here called Rakaware. The city of Raqqa is the next stop on our apocalyptic journey. There's a bright turquoise glaze on this shallow bowl, and it's a beautiful complement to the dark, black, swooping strokes that create the bird painted in its center. A bird in motion. It's easy to see it as a pretty piece of painted ceramics, and it is, but it's also so much more. It tells a tale of creation, destruction, transformation, and rebirth. Masame Farhad is a curator of Islamic art at the Freer.
By looking at just this one bowl with a bird on it, you can get a lot about the past, especially about Raqqa, a city that, you know, was destroyed once, it was destroyed again.
Wait, what? All that from looking at this one bowl? Let's look more closely at the clues. So we have a bird.
It's a little worn, but it has this beautiful design of a water bird, really done with a very few spontaneous strokes. So it sort of really captures the form and the spirit of the bird. And then when you think of where Raqqa is situated, birds, the aquatic life, played an important part in the life of the people.
Raqqa is a city situated on the Euphrates River in Syria. Hot, humid, swampy. You may have heard of this city on the news. The Islamic militant group ISIS captured it and used it as its capital. It's gone through some extremely volatile times. In the 1200s, when this bowl was made, the river port of Raqqa was a crowded, whirling center of city life.
I would sort of imagine it as a very international city.
Another clue about this bowl's meaning can't be seen but can be felt. This piece, like all Raqqaware, is heavy.
I've actually held this bowl, and with many of the ceramics from Raqqa, they have a coarse body. That really tells you that these were utilitarian objects. These were objects that were used, you know, on a fairly regular basis.
The dishes could be stacked and they wouldn't break. And there's a special finish on a lot of Raqqaware, a shimmering, otherworldly quality that can be seen in some of the glaze. If you look very closely at the other pieces in this cabinet, it's that quality, that silvery shimmer that sets some Raqqaware apart.
Having luster-painted ceramics is a luxury because it means that the vessels had to be fired twice. You had to get the metal glazes. So it was sort of the Tiffany of its time.
So we're not talking royalty here. They would have used gold and silver platters. But Raqqaware was pretty darn nice for its time. And this is where the story turns. Danger arrived around the year 1260. The Mongols invaded and the city was demolished. Homes, buildings, and lives destroyed. Raqqaware disappeared. Amidst the destruction, unbeknownst to anyone, Raqqaware was still around, but buried deep underground. And underground, a silent and invisible transformation was taking place. Now fast forward hundreds of years into the late 19th and 20th centuries. There were great expositions in Chicago and Paris that brought the arts and cultures of the wider world to audiences far removed.
As a result, there was a great interest in the Middle East, and many collectors, both European and Americans, traveled either to Europe to buy Middle Eastern art, or they actually traveled to the Middle East.
Charles Lang Freer, the founder of the Freer Gallery of Art, he was one of them.
Freer was attracted to the object's subtle tones. They resembled some of the art he admired that came from Japan and China. And suddenly, rockaware reappeared. For hundreds of years, it had not been seen, and then pieces showed up in Syria and later at international art markets. It's likely that rockaware really did rise from the grave. Looting was popular at the time. Researchers have since confirmed that many pieces of rockaware spent hundreds of years underground. And during that time, in the rich, moist soil, this invisible transformation took place. An additional silvery, almost ghost-like, sparkling finish appeared. Charles Freer, he loved it. He loved the ways that the glaze seemed to create subtle tonal differences from object to object. Curator Farhad explains.
Most of these pieces were actually underground. I mean, they were buried. The glazes reacted with the moisture in the soil and developed the sheen. But that's what really attracted Freer. So we have cupboardfuls.
Amazingly, rockaware was transformed into something more striking, highly valued, and in some ways even more beautiful than it had ever been. It was reborn. Be sure to look closely for that silvery sheen as you explore the works on display in this gallery and around the museum. The elaborately decorated scrolls in this gallery are deeply treasured. Let your eyes move across the room. The gold and silver that adorn some of the scrolls can almost appear to rise off the page. The famous Lotus Sutra scroll, Where You Stand Now, is illuminated by silver, gold, and other bright colors, and its text describes a paradise even more stunning, the afterlife.
It describes the world you want to go to.
James Ulak is senior curator of Japanese art at the Freer Sackler.
A world of beauty, of peace, of salvation, tranquility. It talks about how paradise looks. It talks about the levels of existence. And its sheer descriptive power, I think, inspired artists.
In the 11th century, Buddhists believed that they were facing the end of the world, an all-encompassing apocalypse. It was a period referred to as the third and final age. It was predicted in Buddhist teachings that darkness would descend and last for 10,000 years, and all the teachings of the Buddha would be lost forever. The Lotus Sutra scroll and other scrolls here describe the afterlife. They were kind of like time capsules.
They were buried in bronze containers that were then put in jars. The thinking was that whatever happens in this age of decline and degeneracy and perhaps the very end of the world, in a future time when the Buddha comes again, the beautiful and perfect word will be there for believers. So it's a time capsule in that sense.
In the 1100s in Japan, the decline was seemingly right around the corner. Buddhism predicted the coming of a final age called Mappo.
You start to see writings about Mappo probably in the early 800s. And a real change in Japanese government probably toward the end of the 1100s.
There was an imperial system in place in Japan with emperors and empresses, and that system was usually held in place by large clans. It was like a leader being supported by various political groups. But
toward the middle of the 1100s, two major clans really slugged it out for about 40 years in a variety of civil wars. And for all intents and purposes, ended the polite fiction of the emperor being the one of absolute authority.
And they formed what was called the first shogun, or military government. But by the end of the century, central Japan was totally ravaged. Temples destroyed, icons destroyed, famine, disease.
All these things happening at once. One would think, a believer seeing this would say, whoa, things are falling apart, just as predicted in the teachings.
And there was more. By the 1200s, the Mongols were on the march, moving across China and what we now know of as the Korean Peninsula. They were moving closer to Japan with each passing day. It was like everything was at risk.
In this period of apocalypse or apocalyptic thinking, to create a sutra of considerable beauty was a way of gaining merit.
So it was during this time that regional leaders and people with money sponsored the creation of these beautiful sutra scrolls. It was an attempt to preserve some of the teachings of the compassionate Buddha in the face of this danger. And
you paid up your insurance in the afterlife.
And the beautiful scene here, radiant hills and flowing waters, it turns out it wasn't too hard to get into this paradise. James explains the Lotus Sutra comes from a branch of Buddhism that became increasingly popular during this time. It's called Pure Land Buddhism.
Pure Land Buddhism had actually minimal requirements. And those minimal requirements were, number one, faith, an invocation of the name of the Amida Buddha at a moment of terror or impending death was enough to get you in.
So the Lotus Sutra was a how-to guide, visual reassurance, and a time capsule. Sutra scrolls were a message to future generations. If there was a future on the horizon, these were teachings worth protecting.
Burying protects. Burying is like planting a seed. Burying is looking to the future.
The central courtyard of the Freer Gallery is an oasis of calm. It was very intentionally designed. Large floor-to-ceiling arched windows open to another layer of arches, protecting covered walkways. In the middle of the courtyard, green shrubs encircle the central fountain. In the summer, that fountain pours water cascading gently into the shallow surrounding pool. It's a haven within a haven. Charles Freer wanted this museum to serve as a kind of retreat from what he saw as an increasingly turbulent outside world. During his lifetime, he was regularly troubled by a feeling that the world as he knew it was coming to an end. To understand that feeling, we need to get to know Freer as more than just an art collector.
Freer actually made his fortune manufacturing railroad cars, and the railroad industry was sort of, to the late 19th century, what the tech industry is to the 21st.
Lee Glazer is the curator of American art at the Freer Sackler. As she tells it, the railroad industry was a really volatile business.
It was too much speculation in the railroad industry that caused a sequence of economic meltdowns in the 1880s and then in the 1890s. Freer, while he was extremely methodical and sort of cautious by nature, was also under incredible stress all the time because of this business.
And on top of the work stress, Freer lived in the extremely crowded Detroit of the late 1800s.
Detroit in the Gilded Age would have been noisy, smoky, dirty to 21st century eyes and noses.
Although Freer worked in the railroad industry, he was increasingly frustrated by the industrialized world.
So, like every moment of sort of stress or transition in his business life is marked by a collapse in his health, mental and physical health.
Day to day, Freer sought to escape. He treasured beautiful objects to look at and a quiet, uncrowded place to admire them from. Long before the museum existed, he made his home that haven.
And for Freer, it really was a retreat from the clamor of the Gilded Age and the stress of business.
Freer would sit quietly, closed off from the stink and the noise of the city, and just appreciate, unrushed, fine art, and the joys of selected, quiet company. As he neared the end of his life, he wanted the art he'd collected to continue to be calmly, slowly, and peacefully admired. It's one of the reasons why this very museum was constructed.
The building on the outside is very classical. These archways that are fairly large.
Catherine Anderson is a professor of architecture and interior design at George Washington University. Freer was no architect, but he actually made multiple sketches of this building himself. I asked Catherine to help me understand what it is about this museum that creates a special feeling of protection for the works and the visitors.
When you go in, it's very introspective, right? There's a beautiful courtyard. It almost opens itself up once you enter the building, as if you're in another world.
Take a deep breath and just pause here. If you visited the museum in the 1920s, in the courtyard of the Freer Gallery, you would have also noticed live peacocks roaming around. Those peacocks, with their slow walks and gorgeous feathers, they basically embodied the features Freer treasured most: slowness and beauty. Freer's desire for escape is one of the reasons he fell in love with Asian art. He saw the East as a land far from his home. He imagined the art on display here represented places fully removed from the industrialized world. Freer wanted visitors to the museum to have what he said was, quote, ample opportunity to enjoy their emotional reactions. He worked with his architect friend Charles Platt to thoughtfully design a protective and peaceful space, a museum that kept encroaching forces at bay and allowed for the calm appreciation of truly fine art. We hope that this episode of Freer Thinking helped you connect with the architecture, objects, and stories of the Freer Gallery, and to appreciate how sometimes an apocalypse is not the end of the world. Sometimes, it's the beginning of something new.